Case number 13-5061, Sabina Living et al. Versus Internal Revenue Service et al. Appellants. Mr. Rothenberg for appellants, Mr. Albin for appellees.
May it please the court. This case presents a question of exceptional importance to the administration of the tax laws. Can the Secretary of Treasury regulate the practice of tax return preparers in an effort to weed out those preparers who are unscrupulous or unethical? The district court held that Congress, in enacting 31 U.S.C. 330, has unambiguously foreclosed the commissioner from doing so. That decision is wrong and should be reversed.
That's one way of phrasing it. You're looking at it from a very negative approach, though. The question would first be, has Congress empowered? Not whether Congress has foreclosed, but whether Congress has given you.
Well, you clearly have to have that first, and then you look.
Yeah. I understand the City of Arlington says we don't call it jurisdictional, but we still have to determine, did Congress leave an ambiguity that empowered you to make that determination?
Well, the way
you don't have all the power in the world, and then say, did Congress unambiguously take it away? And that seemed to be the way you were approaching it in your brief as well as here.
Well, I think the way to approach it is the way this court has approached it when it's addressing step one, and that is look at this court in the en banc decision mediation board has identified four things to look at: text, structure, overall statutory scheme, and the problem Congress thought to solve. And when you look at those, we think it's clear that subsection A1 of section 330 permits the Treasury to do exactly what it did.
One thing we often start with is ordinary language, and it seemed to me a striking omission from your brief was any effort to cite any usage of words like these, regulate the practice of representatives of persons before a particular agency, which were taken to encompass the kind of relationship that's involved here. You don't try it in the brief. I assume you looked but couldn't
find it. There's not a lot of, there's very little law on how you define representative, how you define practice.
No, but just ordinary language. Did you find any usage in any published place, perhaps even an unpublished, but certainly published would be better, in which words like that were used to characterize people whose only function was to help other people fill in a form that they were required by law to fill in?
Well, I think preparers do much more than just fill out a form.
I'm sure many of them do.
They put their P10 number down there, and they say, we have looked, essentially they say, this is the amount that this taxpayer owes in tax, or this is the amount this taxpayer is entitled to claim a refund for.
In other words, they fill in the form. They help the taxpayer fill in the form.
Well, they're not mere scriveners. They have to know what the...
No, no one suggested they were mere scriveners, but it doesn't sound to me, and so I'd be interested in any case where these words were used to communicate such a meaning.
We could not find a case comparable to this one.
I'm not talking about legal cases.
No,
I'm talking about anything in public discourse.
Well, the operative words would be representatives, practice, and certainly the
before the case.
Well, that's in A2.
The representatives is usual. It's usually an agent, right?
If you look at the dairy, go back to 1884. Mm-hmm. The words Congress used were agents, attorneys, or other persons. Mm-hmm. And when Congress recodified it in 82, it used the word representatives. Yeah. Didn't use those three words.
That's the one now operative. Right.
Right. That's the operative one. And it said these changes were stylistic only. So representative has to mean more than agent, because the original words were agent, attorneys and other persons. And clearly, tax return preparers are other persons.
And what about the cross-reference, which the district court relied on, to A2D, advise and assist persons in presenting their cases? That is not helpful for your position, obviously.
It's not helpful, but it's also the incorrect way to interpret the statute. The operative provision is A1. Mm-hmm. A2 essentially imposes admission requirements on those who are admitted to practice. And if you look at the exemption, attorneys and CPAs clearly practice, they are exempt from those admission requirements.
How many years did these were these words on the books from the original version until the Treasury decided one day that it could regulate tax preparers?
The 1884 mm-hmm. words were there, I believe, until the recodification.
Right. And that's how many years?
That's about a century.
And after a century, Secretary suddenly decides these words empower us to do this, or the commission?
Well, another 30 years on top of that.
Well, actually.
Another 30 years on top of that, right.
Well, what I would like to do is mention that this court en banc, and again, the mediation board case said, the mere fact the board has never before claimed the authority does not mean that such authority, if granted by Congress, has ceased to exist.
I mean, doesn't make it irrelevant either, counsel. 130 years of not thinking that it gave you that power might make it a little less convincing when you say it does.
Well, we think the whole point of administrative regulation and Chevron deference is that it's an evolving process. It's not.
Which is an evolving process?
The ability of the administrative agency to determine what it can and cannot do under the governing statute. Now, admittedly, until recently, the Internal Revenue Service did not choose to have tax return preparation by itself, by a non-enrolled agent, attorney, or CPA, come within circular.
Did the IRS say that it had the authority but was exercising its discretion not to?
It didn't say anything. Right. And again, you can have a prior Secretary of the Treasury decide not to exercise,
sure.
And you can have a later one decide, okay.
Certainly, I realize arbitrary and capricious is more APA language than Chevron language, but certainly arbitrary and capricious has an overlap here, and to make a change without acknowledging that a change has been made and without explaining the change, why things are different, that would be arbitrary and capricious, wouldn't it?
Well, the Secretary clearly did all that. He did explain the change. There was a whole study. There was a 6-month process. They had public hearings. They had 500 comments. This was a big deal.
I know Treasury employs people that go over to the chair and talk to the members over there or their staffs once a year at least, and it lasts about 364 days, with suggested changes that they want in the law. Has Treasury ever proposed to Congress that they make such a change? Yeah.
Well, there have been, as the briefs point out, a number of bills to specifically empower the Treasury to do this.
They have the Congress at some point put in some language about how you regulate preparers, didn't it?
Well, Congress put in, added some things to 330, added sections C and D to mm-hmm. cover certain things that maybe were not crystal clear under A1 mm-hmm. and A2.
And so, at that point, Congress did not. Or none of those won't. Did Congress say anything that makes it clear that the Secretary has the authority to do this?
Well, we think A1 already makes that clear. And we think
that it seemed that Congress was operating on an assumption that A1 did not do that in enacting, as Judge Sintel says, all sorts of regulations of tax preparers. Over the years, that those wouldn't have been necessary had A1 covered tax preparers, right?
I don't think so. The provisions that Congress imposed under the so-called preparer penalty provisions, these are all after-the-fact specific mm-hmm. sanctions. Right. That's not what the preparer regulations we're talking about today deal with. They're before-the-fact, essentially. These are admission, essentially admission requirements. Before we're gonna say that you're empowered to file a tax return.
Well, that's continuing education and fees. The problem here, as you're well aware, is this imposes costs on individual tax preparers, some of whom they'll either be passed on the costs or they'll get out of the business or
surely,
not go into it.
Surely, and the Treasury recognized that when it issued its study and in the preamble to the regulations recognized all that. Every government program doesn't necessarily come as a costless. I mean, this overall, the problem that identified with the IRS was that
I was just responding to your point that these were simply qualifications to practice. Well, it's more than that in the sense of what comes in terms of continuing. And that's all I was saying.
Right.
And you're, of course, right. Regulation comes with costs.
It does. And the preamble pointed out they tried to minimize the costs. A lot of the continuing legal education you can do at least now on, assuming it's going to go, on a IRS website. And it may not involve many costs. The cost to the Treasury, where tax return preparers get it wrong and get it wrong often and big time, is pointed out in the preamble, pointed out in the study cited in our briefs that was issued in 2009. And this is a current problem. It was not a problem in the 1950s. In the 1950s, a taxpayer could walk into the local IRS office, give them their documents, and ask them to prepare the return. Well, can't do that now.
This is really not relevant to the statutory interpretation question, but it is curious. There's a number and a footnote in the red brief indicating that 61% of, I guess, the efforts by tax preparers who were actually specially certified by the IRS contained errors. Has there been any comparison between them and the broad mass of tax preparers?
You mean between enrolled agents?
Yes.
I do not know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But the study did indicate how many were wrong, and some of the amicus briefs filed indicate, errors of 60% of the returns. That was, again, anecdotal. It was not a statistical analysis.
Regulations apply only to paid preparers, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
If you have a pro bono service, a church or some other nonprofit has a pro bono service, that's not regulated, right?
I don't think so. I'll double-check but I don't think so.
So if the concern of the IRS is the mistakes that are made by preparers, are there any fewer mistakes made by pro bono? Has there been a comparison on pro bono with paid preparers?
You mean how many?
If they're getting it wrong, so we're going to regulate the ones who are paid. Are the ones who are not paid, the pro bonos that you find in church basements and other similar things, are they getting it any better? And if not, why are they not regulated?
Well, IRS is trying to do this one step at a time. And the biggest problem is the paid preparer returns. Have
there been a comparison?
I do not believe there has been a comparison.
Well,
on the non-paid versus paid?
Yeah.
I don't remember reading that in the...
How do you know it's the biggest problem if there's been no comparison then?
Well, again, it's what does IRS think is the biggest problem and what can they tackle?
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem was, paid preparers in the sense that there are people that market to car dealers. Hey, prepare tax returns too. You can make a little extra money on the side. IRS would like to think that they would prepare returns that are accurate.
Can you return again to the A2D language, presenting their cases? And what's your response to that?
My response to that is A2 mm-hmm. does not define A1. A2 just establishes fitness and character characteristics. It's essentially
but
like
it
an
implies
admission.
That the people who are within the scope of A1 are people who are going to be presenting cases.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps, but not entirely. I mean, there are
what do you
four
mean by
subsets. Well, there are four subsets of A2.
Well, you have to have each of those. They're joined by an and.
No, you don't have to have each of those. It's the commissioner is...
Well, it says you have to have each of them. You have to have
no,
good character.
May, in its discretion, decide A, B, C, and D. Doesn't mean you have to have all four of those.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if you have all four of those, but not necessarily. You might have someone who is incapable of presenting a case, but may be very, very good at performing valuable service. Mm-hmm. And the district court nowhere even mentioned.
So you're construing and as meaning or?
Well, sometimes and does mean or. And we pointed out the Supreme Court has even indicated sometimes and means or. But this is not a list where you have to have A, B, C, and D.
To demonstrate A, good character, B, good reputation, C, necessary qualifications, and D, competency to advise.
But that gives
that sounds like a conjunctive.
Well, Judge Santel, that gives the commissioner, the commissioner could decide just to see if there's good character and good reputation and forget about C and D. That would be perfectly acceptable.
The word and doesn't do anything in that sentence.
It says the commissioner in establishing admission requirements can get certification that all four of those items are covered, but it doesn't have to say you cannot be admitted unless you show all four of those. That's the district court's error in this. The district court read...
It's somebody's error.
Well, the district court read A2 as establishing essentially...
Read it as meaning what it said. Right?
I respectively disagree with that
interpretation.
It seems to me if you look at this A, B, C, D, one way of looking at them is that it's not particularly focused on shedding, it's not trying to shed light on who's covered. It's listing sort of departments of human characteristics that are being analyzed, being the secretary is authorized to look at: character, reputation, qualifications, competency. If you look at it that way, then the tail end here, to advise and assist persons in presenting their cases, seems like something that would be intended to be reflected in A, B, and C as well as D. Follow me? This is not an enumeration of the four categories of people or four categories of services. It's four categories of characteristics of people who provide services. Does that not suggest that the full language, the tail end language of D, is relevant to A, B, and C, and therefore relevant to A1?
But not all folks who practice before the Treasury necessarily would be doing the same type of jobs. And what you can
granted.
So a preparer may be a wonderful person knowing what the tax law is, but a terrible person in an adversarial situation. So maybe he would be terrible at presenting a case, but he would still be a wonderful person because he provides valuable service. That would still be someone who is entitled to practice before the Department of Treasury. And the under the district court's reading, that person is not entitled to practice.
Now you're putting a very narrow spin on presenting their cases. You seem to be focusing it on oral presentation to a body, whereas it seems on its face to cover preparation of briefs, which can be done by someone quietly in his office.
Well, it could also be, as the commissioner's amicus brief points out, presenting the case could also be filing a return that claims a refund.
That would be an awfully strange use of presenting a case, wouldn't it? Well, you said early in your presentation you couldn't find an instance where it was used that way, I thought.
Well, that's why we have not put that forth as our prime argument.
Okay.
But I just want to point out that, it depends on how you interpret the words presenting a case.
What about the idea that in the tax world generally there's a difference between tax compliance and tax controversy, and that this is focused on the tax controversy box?
Well, we disagree with that. Pointed out in our briefs, we don't think that the tax world is neatly divided into binary characteristics. There are many, many jobs, and it doesn't mean that you have to, if you fall on one side, the commissioner can't regulate. If you fall on the other side, the commissioner can regulate it. Again, do the words, I hate to beat a dead horse, especially one from the Civil War era, but again, the point here is, do the words of the statute unambiguously foreclose and prevent Chevron deference? And we do not think they do. And we think the operative provisions are A1, and the district court misinterpreted A2 as establishing a limit on A1.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Alban?
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Alban, and I represent the three independent tax preparers. Congress never gave the IRS the authority to license tax preparers, and the IRS cannot give itself that power. The agency's expansive new interpretation of Section 330 is foreclosed by the plain meaning of the statute under all three traditional tools of statutory interpretation: the plain language of the statute read as a whole, the overall statutory scheme enacted by Congress, and the legislative history and purpose of the statute. The IRS's position turns administrative law on its head by presuming that anything not forbidden by Congress is authorized. But this circuit flatly rejected that same argument in Railway Labor Executives Association and in ABA v. FTC, explaining that were courts to presume a delegation of power absent an express withholding of such power, agencies would enjoy virtually limitless hegemony. Section 330 grants the agency authority to regulate the practice of representatives in much the same way that a court regulates attorneys who appear before it. In other words, Section 330 is about regulating representation during the agency's examination and appeals functions, controversy, which are adversarial and adjudicative. But preparing tax returns is part of collection, also known as compliance, which is non-adjudicative. The IRS's new interpretation of Section 330 is inconsistent with the language of the statute. First, tax preparers are not representatives before the agency. And second, tax preparers do not present cases. There is no case for any representative to present until there's a dispute between the IRS and the taxpayer. It is only when there is a dispute about tax liability.
What about the word may? I mean, that, the response to that was that the word may gives the IRS authority to require these things for particular categories of people, but it's not a mandatory requirement for each particular representative, and so therefore A2D would not be required of everyone.
Well, the entire statute is permissive, Your Honor. The word may appears at the very beginning of the statute before the even regulating the practice of representatives is mentioned.
Yes, I mean, may require is the full verb, right?
May regulate, I believe, Your Honor.
Well, surely the may extends down to A2.
Yeah. Sure.
Right.
And we're not talking about 330A2D in the context of what authority does the agency have to do these things. Instead, we're looking at 330A2D to see what context it provides. As this circuit and the Supreme Court have repeatedly held, we're not just to look to individual statutory provisions in isolation, but we're to look to the statute as a whole. And that's why we're looking to 330A2D, because it provides some meaningful and substantive context that explains what the practice of representatives of persons before the Department of Treasury consists of. It's advising and assisting persons in presenting their cases. And the list of four items there, the A, B, C, and D under 330A2, that is a conjunctive list. It's joined by the word and. And in the original language from 1884, it, in fact, actually said, and otherwise competent to advise and assist preparers in returning their cases. So this isn't some sort of a la carte list of services you might pick out, and maybe someone wants a tax return preparer who is competent, and another one wants a tax return preparer who is reputable. Instead, it only makes sense to read these four items together. If you have someone who's representing you before the agency, you want them to have good character and good reputation. You want them to have the necessary qualifications and be competent to advise and assist you in presenting their case. So that's why 330A2D provides additional context for understanding the language that appears in 330A1, Your Honor.
Counsel, do we know enough about the history of the claims that gave rise to the original statute to say that the claims involved were entirely ones where the government was resisting?
We don't know for certain about that, Your Honor, but we do know that these were not mandatory claims. These were not in any way analogous to a tax return, which is something that you have to file on every taxpayer has to file on at least an annual basis. Here, the soldiers who were bringing their claims for lost horses had the discretion to bring those claims, and the fact that they were employing representatives rather than just submitting some paperwork indicates that in fact, these claims were contested. In addition, the history indicates that these representatives, these attorneys and claims agents who were appearing before Treasury at the time, that they were standing in the place of these soldiers. The June 6, 1884 legislative history from the discussion in the House on what the concern was that many of these soldiers lived hundreds or thousands of miles away from Washington, D.C., and so they wouldn't know what was happening with their appointed representative who was presenting their claim before the Treasury.
I think the going back to your initial point, what the IRS is really arguing is that the scope of the authorization here is ambiguous. And given that, as they argue it, ambiguity, we should therefore defer to their interpretation of these words, representative practice before.
Well, Your Honor, the IRS certainly maintains...
Why is it not ambiguous, I guess, is the question that they would pose.
Sure. Section 330 is not ambiguous because the plain meaning of these terms excludes tax return preparers. Tax preparers are not representatives before the agency. They do not act in any sort of representative capacity. And notably, when they do sign a tax return, all they're signing is, to their knowledge, there's nothing fraudulent in the tax return. In order for the tax return to actually become a legally active document, a binding...
Who are they representing, then? They're not representing anyone?
No, Your Honor. Tax return preparers are not performing in a representational capacity. Preparing a tax return is not a representative act. It is performing a service, certainly, but there's no representation. And, one of the ways we can see this is the fact that they cannot sign the tax return on behalf of the taxpayer. The taxpayer has to sign it themselves. Secondly, we know that tax preparers do not advise and assist in presenting any cases. Tax return preparation is a mandatory self-assessment. It's in the compliance or collection part of the agency's function. It's non-adversarial, and even the agency's own assessment of a taxpayer's tax liability is conducted in an ex parte manner where there's no right to a hearing or a representative.
Yeah. Note the study that said how many mistakes the preparers made. Is there any comparison to how many IRS employees make as opposed to preparers?
There have been a number of studies, Your Honor, but they somehow seem to have gone unmentioned in the IRS's 2009 return preparer review. In addition, as was mentioned earlier, we did provide very briefly in a footnote a mention of the tax returns prepared by the volunteer tax assistance program, who are trained by the IRS themselves,
yeah.
And that's where that 61% error rate comes from. So even among tax return preparers who are trained by the IRS, the audit by TIGTA, the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, found that error rate was quite high, 61%.
Quite apart from ambiguity or unambiguity, you argue that you have not given up the reasonableness argument. That argument rests on the proposition that you from the outset briefed it with reference to reasonableness, although I guess you didn't mention the magic, in some circles, word prong two.
Well,
right?
Your Honor, we did argue under both Chevron step one and step two, and we did explain that in both our briefs in the lower court and our briefs in this court.
Here, I believe I'm correct. The only references to Chevron two are in footnotes, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. However,
it's only marginally even in your brief before us. Is that enough to preserve?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Certainly the focus of our briefs is on Chevron step one, but the arguments that we're making that the plain language of the statute forecloses the agency's interpretation, those also apply in Chevron step two, that the agency's interpretation is unreasonable. As a matter of brevity, we preserved those arguments in the footnote, but we made them under both steps of the Chevron test. And as this court has done on
some... Our former colleague, Abner McVie, used to say, if you want us to read it, put it up where our eyes are. If God meant for us to read footnotes, he would put our eyes on the vertical plane, not the horizontal.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that entirely. And that's why we made the arguments in the body of the brief, but merely noted that we were making them under step one and step two in a footnote. As I mentioned before, there is a distinction in the tax administration world, and the IRS disputes the distinction between compliance and controversy, which is the industry terms, but even the IRS's own regulations state that there is a distinction between the collections process, which is where tax returns are prepared and filed, and the examinations and appeals process. And in the examinations and appeals process, that's actually adjudicative and adversarial. You do have a right to a representative, and that's where representatives do appear on behalf of taxpayers. But in the collections process, it's simply a mandatory self-assessment of one's tax liability, and there is no right to be represented because there is no hearing. The IRS's own assessment of your tax liability is conducted ex parte. So the distinction between either compliance and controversy, if you want to look at it in the terms that the industry uses, or even look at it in the terms used in the Code of Federal Regulations, between collections and examinations and appeals is critical here. The representatives that are being referenced in Section 330.
Collections on the one hand and examinations and appeals on the other?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a fourth function that's criminal, but it's not terribly relevant to this case, so I didn't bring it up. But yes, there are those four functions. Those appear in the Code of Federal Regulations as we list on page 2 through 5 of our brief, illustrating what each of those functions is. And even under federal statute, in addition to the regulations themselves, the 26 U.S.C. 7521 is what provides that taxpayers do have a right to a representative. And that representative is someone who has the power of attorney. That power of attorney provision is important because the IRS has never held that you have to have a power of attorney in order to prepare a tax return. In fact, under the IRS's own regulations, in order to represent someone before the IRS, you have to have their power of attorney. But the IRS has never held, still does not today hold, that you have to have someone's power of attorney in order to prepare their tax return. Your Honor, opposing counsel described the administrative regulations as an evolving process. But while that may be the case, and the agency certainly can make adjustments to its interpretation over time, courts have repeatedly held that the level of policy decision that's being made here is much more appropriately made by Congress than by an agency.
What do you mean by that, level yeah. of policy decision?
Well, Your Honor, as opposing counsel explained, these regulations are of, he said, tremendous importance to the agency, and these are sweeping regulations that affect hundreds of thousands of tax returns.
We spend our days with sweeping regulations made by various federal agencies under authority delegated by Congress or created by ambiguities in legislation. Where are you getting any traction by saying that would happen here?
By saying which would happen here, Your
that
Honor?
That there is a sweeping regulation being made here with strong policy decisions.
Well, Your Honor, in cases like Brown and Williamson, this court has noted that when there is a major policy change, we have to expect that we have to analyze these policy changes from a common sense perspective as to the manner in which Congress is likely to delegate this sort of authority.
Colors how much ambiguity we're willing to tolerate.
Yes, Your Honor. I think you look to the plain language.
Is that your point? Is that the point of Brown and Williamson? Major questions reduces the deference that we would ordinarily give?
I think it may, Your Honor, but I think it's also, even if it doesn't change the deference.
I mean, the problem with that is how do we tell what's a major question, going to Judge Sintel's point, which is, we see a lot of cases that seem major.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You're saying what Judge Williams, you wouldn't have, but what Judge Williams and I had to put up with in the Order 500 FERC series, changed the whole regulatory scheme for pipelines.
I sympathize
with the electric side of FERC. It changed the whole regulatory system. That was all done by reg, not by statute.
I sympathize entirely, Your Honor. However, the statute at issue here simply does not contain the sort of ambiguity that would allow for such
you're suggesting that here we have an extension to a whole new domain, which was even in Order 500 was not the case.
Right.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, as the Brown and Williamson Court held, it's Congress is unlikely to delegate this sort of authority in so cryptic a fashion. It seems very hard to believe that Congress in 1884 intended to delegate the authority to regulate tax return preparers to the Treasury through the language that appears in Section 330, and then over the 130-some years that followed, never made any clarification to it, never made any substantive modification that would indicate that the agency has this authority once tax return preparers actually came into existence as an actual profession.
Does the City of Arlington at all change the analysis with respect to the agency's ability to define the scope of its regulatory authority?
No, Your Honor, it does not. The City of Arlington case was about the jurisdictional question of which statutes an agency is empowered to interpret, also known as sort of a Chevron Step Zero question. That's not at issue here because in Section 330, it specifically mentions the Department of Treasury, and neither side contests that the Department of Treasury is the agency charged with administering this statute.
I don't think that's all the City of Arlington was saying.
No, it's not,
City
Your Honor.
City of Arlington was saying, contrary to what I'd always believed, that the agency's Chevron deference extends to its interpretation of its jurisdiction, whether that's defined as which specific statute or simply how far a statute reaches.
Your Honor, I believe it's City of Arlington is about the scope of authority that an agency has to determine its jurisdiction, and the jurisdictional question is not present here. But what is notable about
City... Well, but you are saying that they extend it to a whole new realm of regulation.
That's true, Your Honor.
If that's not jurisdictional, then maybe you're heightening Justice Roberts' point on dissent that maybe jurisdiction is not the right word, but...
Well, as you know,
it sounds like jurisdiction.
As you know, Your Honor, there was quite a bit of dispute and confusion over what exactly is a jurisdictional claim under Chevron. Yeah. But the issue that was being adjudicated in the City of Arlington case was about whether or not the FCC was charged with enforcing a specific statute. And that issue, which is the Chevron Step Zero question, is simply not present here. What I would say is notable, though, about the City of Arlington decision is that all nine justices in all three opinions that were issued by the court reaffirmed the Chevron test as being the relevant test for assessing an agency's authority to act once we know which statute it is they're empowered to interpret. And even more important than that, in responding to the concerns raised by Chief Justice Roberts, in the majority opinion authored by Justice Scalia, the court said that the fox in the hen house syndrome is to be avoided by taking seriously and applying rigorously in all cases statutory limits on agency's authority. That's what the district court did here, Your Honor, and that's why the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Give a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Of course, all of the cases involving whether or not an agency has violated Chevron Step 1, turn on their unique facts. But it's somewhat useful to examine the cases in which this court has invalidated a regulation under Chevron Step 1, and there's only been a handful since Chevron came down in 1984. And in every one of those, this court, when the court has invalidated, they've said Congress decided who, what, when, and how in the statute. And in those three instances, one of which is mediation board, and I have the sites for the other ones, the Congress made a specific, said X, and the agency decided Y. That's not what we have here. We have a statute that says that if you practice, representatives to practice before the Department of the Treasury. And Yeah, unless those words establish who, what, when, how, then it seems to me the
Go ahead. Did we in American Bar Association turn on Chevron 1 or Chevron 2?
It would have to be Chevron. It's not on my list, so it must have been Chevron 2.
I was thinking of Chevron 1. I don't have your list, but my recollection about what I wrote there was Chevron 1.
Well, the list I have.
Certainly there, hadn't thought of the comparison until today, but there the FTC was purporting to regulate a new profession not included in the original regulatory schemes. They waited a lot fewer years, but we held that Congress had simply not empowered them to regulate the bar, the legal profession. And if they'd meant to, they would have said so. Is that the, whether we turned it on one or two, doesn't that hurt you?
No, I think one is a low bar. One is a very low bar. And it's, again, if the text of the statute.
It has to be ambiguous on the very point in question.
Agreed.
I don't know whether that's low or maybe it's a narrow gate rather than a low bar.
Well, as I pointed out in my original argument.
I'm not sure it's such a low bar. I mean, the court and this court have said that you're supposed to use all the tools of interpretation and come to a conclusion at the end of doing so. So I think the low bar language, which is in your brief as well, you don't see that in cases like City of Arlington, for example, as Mr. Albert pointed out.
But again, when I looked at those cases, it was, again, as I mentioned, it was X versus Y. It was, can the mediation board take order a representational hearing in the en banc decision of mediation board when the statute said, no, it has to be the parties. So the mediation board's regulation was struck down.
I'm just not sure that your list is exhaustive on the Chevron 1 case.
I think it's probably not.
Well, since post 84, we looked at, again, I'm not talking about pre 84, but again, our bottom line is that unless the language of A1 unambiguously forecloses what the commissioner is intending to do, we think the commissioner has, under Chevron, has the right to.
Why doesn't the IRS require the power of attorney form for tax return preparers, since those are supposed to apply for representation before the agency?
A power of attorney is if someone is acting as an agent, okay, specific agent.
I think it says representative, representation, right, in the regulation.
Well, it gives essentially agent power. The tax return preparer is not an agent, as my learned colleague pointed out. It's not an agent. But that's the point. The original statute included people besides agents. So representatives is a term that is broader than simply an agent.
Are you putting a lot of weight on the term in the original statute, other people?
No, I'm not.
Other persons?
Well, my point is that shows that the word representative is not narrowly defined as just an agent.
Well,
because that's the words that it came from.
Yeah, there are doctrines that limit such extraordinary broad language, right? That a very general word has to be read in light of the more specific words by which it's surrounded.
Okay, and if you read the general word representative and look at its derivation, it's more than just agents, which is our point. And their point,
it's agents and attorneys.
And
what
other persons.
What we have in the original statute.
The original statute has three things: agents, attorneys, and other persons. So I mean,
the mileage you get out of persons is necessarily limited by the two other words. That's a
yeah. I actually don't necessarily
undisputed
agree
proposition.
With that. Yeah. Are there any further questions for us?
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.